We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now that's what I call science. Hello, listeners. You're tuned into That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio and podcast show bringing you independent and interesting STEM, so that's science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine, from Tasmania. This show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium news station, so head on over to edge.org.au for more information about them. I'd like to begin today's episode by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we're recording, the Palo and Pakana. We're recording here on Luchwita, but as we are a podcast, we would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from where you, our listener, are tuning in from. On behalf of everyone here in the studio, I pay my respects to elders past and present. My name is Ollie Dove, and we have a very exciting guest for you today, listeners, in that if you've been listening to That's What I Call Science from the very, very beginning, back in 2019, you might actually recognise her voice. But I'm going to pass on over to my co-host, Emma Hamasaki, to introduce her.
Thanks, Ollie. Well, today we have a special guest, Dr. Bianca Deans, who researched the chemistry within native and endemic Tasmanian plant species. Bianca is a lover of all wild places, plants, and is also really passionate about STEM. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bianca.
Thank you so much for having me, both of you. It's really exciting to be back on the air a few years after founding that with a fantastic group of people. It's absolutely blossoming, and I'm so excited that you recently were awarded the Eureka Prize. Huge congratulations.
Would you mind sharing with us a little bit about yourself and, you know, what your passions and interests are, so we kind of get an idea of what kind of person you are?
Absolutely. So I have a deep passion for STEM. My background in science was definitely founded in a love of being outdoors and being curious. And so I grew up in Hobart and have lived in Tasmania my whole life. And I think it's a great backyard and a fantastic place, a melting pot of science, engaging people and people who really support the passions that you can develop. So I've always loved plants and bushwalking, and naturally that progressed as I went through school to growing a variety of indoor plants, and my family's really inspired that love as well. And then when I got to university, I thought, yes, let's do science. And as I kind of learned more and more about science, I looked for the bridges between different sciences, because science is so interconnected. So within that, I saw, you know, I love bushwalking on my weekends. I loved how chemistry could see a different lens of that science when I was going bushwalking. And with the plants, it kind of all melded together, and next minute, I'd done my PhD in combining all those three things. Yeah. I also really enjoy seeing different facets to an environment. So ecology was a huge eye-opener for me in my studies, and some really passionate people were always inspiring me to do field work, and that combined bushwalking as well. But getting answers, supporting other scientists, and at the time it was crawling through leaf litter, doing field work for a PhD student when I was in first year, and I saw how much passion you need to do postgraduate study and things like that. But at the end of the day, it was so much curiosity that was driving that. So from that, I kind of looked at ecosystems with that whole system view, and made me think, yeah, I think there could be something that I could look at. And looking at things from chemistry, from interactions between different organisms, from the soil upwards, it's been fascinating, and I still find it really interesting.
Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing, and I totally understand. I can relate with the whole house plant situation. I definitely have a few at home. Wow, what an amazing place to grow up and be able to, you know, as you said, have this as in your back door and be able to explore the wilderness around Hobart, especially. You drive an hour away and it's pretty much like all these different landscapes and geography. So that's awesome. Can you share like a memorable experience or story from like one of your field trips? Or like, was there a time when you were out in the bush that you kind of had this, I really feel connected to plants, like, or I really want to learn more about it?
That's a great question. pretty much every time I go out there. Throughout the seasons, it's really beautiful to see the changing landscape. So you might go to the same location, and often the places that ended up being my field locations, luckily with the support of the Tasmanian Parks and Wildlife, receiving permits to go out into those places and very respectfully but carefully collect specimens for my research in plants. Often the places that were really dear to my heart and coming out, often the Southwest National Park and places like that, that I could see a changing landscape. So yeah, looking at these beautiful species that for the first time that I saw them, I thought they looked a little bit different, and then learning about them, and then as the years went on, having more and more layers to understanding them a bit more, whether that's understanding their flowers a bit differently from what someone's told me, and then later on, for example, understanding a bit more about the chemistry and also maybe the family trees that underpin that if we look at the chemistry of those. So it's just such an enriching view of a landscape, I think. And Tasmania is very lucky. We have almost like a hyper-diverse, we're known as one of those regions for hyper-diversity, and also paleo-endemism, which means that over the years, millions of years, that species would be found in a location, and due to changes in the climate, their geographical range would have been narrowed. And so that often means up in the alpine environments, for example, and some of the species that I looked at in my studies were not only endemic to Tasmania, only found natively in Tasmania, nowhere else in the world, but actually specifically in a quite narrow environment, which made it extra special, I think.
Wow. Is this similar to the pencil pines up on the – I've just heard that they're like a really old endemic species.
So they would be part of that too? Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Wow. My goodness, so interesting. It's kind of like it opens like Pandora's box, where you just like everything's all connected and it's all these stories and reasonings to how things work. That's awesome. Has it been really fun to kind of like – take your friends on your hikes and be able to be like, this is this plant that does this, only grows at this time of the year, like things like that. Like I would definitely be using my skills to that in that way for sure.
That's really funny. It depends on which friends. If it's with my family, that's kind of how that's evolved for me and how I absorb that information. With other friends, there's friends who are like, wow, she's a real plant nerd. I didn't realize into it she is, or she just won't shut up. In terms of, yeah, it's a whole range of people that I walk with. I am part of a beautiful walking club as well, and everyone in that walking club contribute their own knowledge as well, so it's just a great community in that in itself. So they're really supportive of, you know, they've got memories to share about an environment and their personal background, so I think it adds into that nicely. I've also taken some people who have now picked up the research since I finished my research in my PhD, and almost like it felt very biased, but to take them on a bushwalk into the field area and to say, oh, so this is the plant that we sampled, and almost being like a handball moment. You're like, oh, you've read about this, now here is this plant in person, and try not to be too biased or too nerdy, scare them off too quickly, don't be too intense, all those sort of things. But yeah, most of the time, yeah, people are really open to seeing, and also, yeah, that deeper layer of understanding the environment. And I'm always learning so much from people I walk with as well, particularly geologists. I don't have a background in geology. I love rocks, those sort of things, environmental management, history. There's so many elements to it.
And I also feel like having that way of sharing information is actually really meaningful. And I find that I always retain more knowledge when I hear it from a friend or when I'm actually looking at the thing that they're really, really passionate about and talking about. So that's amazing that you get to have that experience. As a plant enthusiast, do you have any particular plant that's your favorite one, or is there like a species that you saw when you were little that you know, just still have this kind of warmth towards, or you just love all of them?
Oh, I love a lot of different plants. So if we're talking in general, so I definitely love indoor plants. I have a few hundred of them, and I'm like a bad plant parent. At times I will feel like I'm neglecting them. But in terms of when we look at Tasmania in particular, I almost had an agenda in my mind that I'd look at certain alpine plants because of that experience of bushwalking and seeing them, and almost seeing them like the low-hanging fruit approach, where I knew where they were and I knew that there was quite limited information about them, but also that they looked really pretty. And so they were really ancient. They looked really gorgeous. And one is Belladonna montana, which is known as mountain rocket, that you will see on the top of Mount Wellington, Quinyani, as well as mostly in the Southwest National Park and places like that, quite high altitudes. And it has kind of, different morphologies, different shapes depending on where it's growing, but the flowers are really distinctive. So they're either white or pale pink, and they're kind of tall in their flower spike as well, and they smell really funky. So if you do see them out, have a bit of a smell if they're in the sunshine. But I like to think of them as the ice vovo plant, because they literally look like an ice vovo biscuit in a flower form. So that's one of my personal favourites.
That's awesome. I'm definitely going to keep my eye out for those in the future. Well, stick with us for part two as we dive deeper into Bianca's passions and learn more about all these different beautiful native plants in Tasmania.
So we sort of heard bits and bobs about things you got up to for your PhD, but what actually was your PhD topic?
So it was a few years ago. I do remember it like it was last month, and I think that's a good thing as well as a bad thing. No, it was all about going out into Tasmania's wilderness and collecting a range of endemic, so only found in Tasmania, and native Tasmanian plants, and extracting their leaves and flowers to try and find new molecules. And so I'm an organic chemist by trade, and that means I love pretty much any molecule that has carbon in it. I'm not really fussy. And we found a whole range of different chemicals within those plants. And we found that plants are really good at creating a diverse range of molecules for different purposes. And many of those molecules, we actually don't know why they created them, but some are really commonly found across some plants. And then others were really quite rare in the sense that they were rare that we haven't seen them before. So one of the key parts of my research was that we were adopting a quite novel extraction method called the pressurized hot water extraction method. It sounds a fancy way to say using a coffee machine that you've got off Gumtree, for example, a secondhand coffee machine, and then using essentially a bottle of vodka within that, so ethanol and water as a mixture, to then extract leaves and flowers that you've ground up. So I got really good at making coffees, but I've never actually made a real coffee before. It's always been plant coffees with, gross, really gross smelling native Tasmanian plants rather than coffee beans. But
That's so amazing. You're basically making an espresso martini out of plants with the water and the coffee. I was going to ask actually, because whenever I hear the word chemicals, I always think of liquid, and I was going to ask how you get a chemical from a plant, because it's not like you squeeze the chemical out of it. So is that's the process of using that coffee machine to extract?
Yeah, so there's many ways of extracting chemicals from plants, and there's like that's a whole history lesson in itself. There's things like macerating, which is essentially you can grind it up in a mortar and pestle, for example. You could flush solvents, so liquids, over many hours or even days. That's ways that I've done in the past. You could use supercritical carbon dioxide, so carbon dioxide that is at the point where it's essentially a liquid, and they flush that through. So many different extraction methods, both modern and quite old, and they each have their own pros and cons. And so this was a method that had been developed with our research group since around 2014, and trying out some of those techniques and really optimizing that and seeing if it worked for a range of different plants. And it turned out it did. So in this case, using water by itself, water is quite polar. That's it's good for some things, of course. If you've got polar molecules, it will dissolve polar things, like dissolves like, but when we heat up water, it also takes on properties that are somewhat non-polar in its nature. So it actually broadens the range that it can dissolve molecules from a sample. So when we add ethanol on top of that, that's a little bit non-polar as well. So we can tweak that to be a little bit broader once again. So that bottle of vodka ended up being kind of that mix, around 40% alcohol per volume.
Awesome. And when you say polar molecule, you're not talking about molecules that you find in the Arctic or Antarctic, I'm presuming.
No. I mean, you could. There might be some marine organisms. I don't know. But yeah, that's a very good point, Ollie. Yeah, so we're talking about the behavior of that molecule in terms of often it's got oxygen with a negative charge, or in terms of a distribution of that charge across a molecule. OH groups, alcohol groups are really common as a polar molecule. Acids as well, those sort of things. So there's a range of different molecules, but yeah, water is probably the most common and widely used polar molecule that we've got as humans.
That's so wild, because in my head, water is such a neutral thing that I drink every day. The fact, thinking of it as something that's polar, is completely goes against what I think water to be.
So you actually had a really key word there. So you said neutral. So neutral pH we're talking here. So pH 7, it could be fine, but in terms of the characteristic of that water and how it behaves and how it can attract other molecules, that's kind of talking more about the bonds within that molecule and the interactions outside of that molecule. So that can be really quite different to your pH, which is all about neutrality, acid and base as well. So there's so many aspects to science that I just
oh, so amazing. And so many different aspects to words that we use every day that have multiple meanings given the context. So during your PhD work, were there any surprising results that you came across that you weren't expecting?
So many. So just before my PhD, I did my honours year, which was 1 year of a crash course of, could this technique of using a coffee machine to extract things, could that, you know, work? And a lot of things didn't work, or I could say they didn't work. It was messy. It was trying out a whole range of different things. And then that kind of equipped me for realizing that a PhD, which could be 3 or 4 years, could be quite unexpected. And that was the case. By the time I started my PhD, I kind of had a hit list in my mind of what endemic and native plants I would look at, particularly ones that were quite ancient, ones that I love, like I mentioned before, the ice vovo plant. And I started going and collecting permits, and therefore going out and collecting plants and starting to organize how I'd approach that. What ended up happening, though, was the really ancient plants such as Belladonna montana, Cinerenes natata, which is known as, we've got native plum, and we've also got Pisonia gunnii, which is another species, and they're all part of the Proteaceae family. They're known as having proteas. Waratah is also part of that big family. But when I started looking at those, there were some things that had been talked about in the past in the literature, but also we started seeing some really interesting molecules. So essentially a backbone that was quite common across a variety of plants outside of that family and seen all throughout the world, but then with side chains within that molecule that were quite unusual and they were behaving really differently too. So it kept me guessing when I was trying to work out what that molecule was. I go, this is, you know, a bit unusual. I could see when I'm trying to characterize these molecules using a variety of different methods, I was going, oh, I think it's this, but it's not this, and that sort of thing. So I got to know sugar molecules really well, because sugar's attached to a lot of these molecules, but then it's what you attach beyond that. It can be quite different. And so we found some novel new molecules. And then what was beautiful about that was some of those novel molecules were consistent or similar across similar ancient proteases. So within Tasmania, we're seeing a really interesting suite of molecules that made me realize that these plants are even more special than I thought they would be.
That sounds very interesting. And I feel like I could just continue asking all these questions, but we will go to the next section. So stick with us, listeners, for part three as we talk a little bit more about Bianca's work into all these Tasmanian species. So you mentioned in the early section about all these species that kind of are interrelated and are under this same branch. Is there like a special name for those kind of species or?
Yeah, absolutely. So often when we think of essentially a family tree, it could be one of genetics, and that's something that humans really do really well. Obviously with modern science, we rely on genetics quite heavily, and things like morphology, so body form, things like that is another way we can classify organisms. And chemistry is another form. So some of the information that I found within my research helped form a little bit of a family tree between these species that we know are genetically linked. They're within the same family, for example. We can kind of date how long they've been evolved along their clade or their branch of evolution. But this was an extra lens, which was not just about their morphology, their body form. It wasn't just about their genetics, but it was another element of chemistry that can give us an indication of how those plants may have adapted to the environment and the sort of pressures that they might have on them. We're not just talking about, you know, pressures of atmosphere here. We're talking about herbivory, for example, or climate conditions, things like that. I can't answer those exactly why they've evolved those molecules, but it definitely gave me an insight into they're growing in similar environments. Maybe there's a common thread here.
Awesome. That's so fascinating. And as Emma was saying at the end of the last section, definitely we could probably go on forever talking about all these different aspects. But since the dark ages of your PhD, what have you been up to?
Oh, that's a good question. So I finished that in 2019, and it's kind of hard to believe that since then there has been COVID. There's been 4 years. It's flown by, but also feel like a lot's been packed into it. So following my PhD, I worked in government for 4 years within tourism statistics. So working with a tourism marketing organisation for Tasmania, Tourism Tasmania, and that was essentially helping people better understand statistics for their business and help create business cases and things like that, but also understanding the importance of tourism within the state. And since then, I've recently started working at the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture at UTAS, more in a capacity of outreach and also creating modules and curriculum-aligned content that really showcase the science behind agriculture and really bring it back to my roots of science. So within that, obviously, science is so interdisciplinary, and agriculture is a great example of that, where you could have a role in agriculture that has so many touch points within science as well.
As a STEM radio and podcast show, we love any sort of outreach in STEM. So what sort of things have you been involved in? Can you give us some examples?
So outreach events at schools, colleges, we've obviously got open days, expos, etc. And then also getting myself really across the Australian curriculum. So mostly from year 7 to 12 is the focus, and reading about what students are going to be learning in the classroom and what their educators are bringing in as experiences and that content. So and then bringing connections to agriculture and science for those. So could we bring some cool case studies? Could we come out into the field for a certain experience and things like that? So providing suggestions. And I'm learning a lot in my role as well. I did study agriculture within my Bachelor of Science. So one of the beautiful things about a Bachelor of Science is you can do a mosaic of different areas of science. And I was spoilt for choice. I didn't have enough room for geology. But I did do some agriculture, and that really sparked my passion for essentially what I'm doing now.
Now, I also know that you're not just a scientist and you're not just an expert in outreach, but you're also pretty musical.
I love music. I think that music is the recharge and also a great social community that I'm so lucky to be a part of. So I sing barbershop for a start. So that's close four-part harmony. I sing that within a big chorus of about 60 members called Hobart Harmony Chorus. And also within that four members, we form Cocktail Hour as a quartet. And we absolutely love creating music together. Makes my heart sing. And within that, there's a lot of science as well, I guess. Sometimes you can be singing and actually hear my, I can hear my bone in my ear vibrate if there's a really close frequency. It's almost like you can't hear the chord anymore. You just hear this buzz. And also overtones are another element of that too. So you might be singing four parts in a chord and then hear a fifth almost like the secret fifth note above it. So an octave above or two octaves above what you're singing. So I absolutely love singing, and it definitely gave me the recharge that I needed for my PhD. And it just is a great opportunity to meet amazing people. And we compete at least once a year within that national scale. But it's a fantastic hobby.
How valuable do you see the connection between creativity and science?
That's a fantastic question. It is so important. Having that creative outlet can really remind you of what drives you, and also in terms of maybe tapping into another side of your brain that could be a little bit more thinking out of the box, or even just letting go. Sometimes we can get really quite stuck in feeling rigid in the way that we approach problems. I think there's a certain element of fluidity that creativity brings. Also letting go. I get goosebumps if I hear really good music. It's like AMSR. I sometimes, I just feel like the endorphin rush you get from music. I also get that from science, and hearing new information and just hear like the neurons are firing. Both hobbies, both passions have their own aha moments, and definitely having creative outlets and having that opportunity for it is so important. Making time for it, if you get passion out of it, is so key.
That's such a wonderful way to end the episode, and it was so brilliant meeting you. And as an original Twixer, you've been such a key part of the show's history that it's like meeting like a hero from the the olden days of Twix. So thank you so much for coming on, and thank you listeners for tuning in. We love bringing you STEM related content, and we really hope you enjoyed the show today. If you love the show, you can get in touch with us by searching That's What I Call Science or That Science Taz on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. My name is Ollie Dove, and I'd like to thank my co-host Emma Hamasaki and our expert guest, Bianca Deans. From us three, we hope you all have a wonderful week. This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. That's What I Call Science is brought to your station and across the nation via the Community Radio Network. You can find the show at all major podcast streaming services and find out more about us from our social media channels. Make sure you like and subscribe to keep up with all the exciting science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine research in Lutruwita, Tasmania. This show is supported and strengthened by Edge Radio, so head over to edgeradio.org.au for more information about them. Thanks for tuning in today, and may your week be STEM-tastic.
Here at That's What I Call Science, we're always keen for more sponsors to engage with. If your organisation is looking to financially support the show spreading Tasmania's STEM achievements with the world, get in touch with us via our social media channels or at thatscience.org.